How are you today?
I'm okay.
This is a pretty good connection. This isn't like Sprint, is it?
No, it's a fiber optic thing.
I guess the future's here, huh, Adam?
The future is here. Well, it's more here than it was there in that 25-year-old interview with comedian Bobcat Goldthwait and Noah Adams. And how fun is that?
Yeah, it's about as much fun as a good spinal tap.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and this month on Playback, it's a great time to think about la plus ça change, you know what I mean? Because that's what we find when we look back. Lots of stuff sounding just like the stuff today, only not quite. We celebrate fathers this month, and a nice round anniversary for the perennial favorite, Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind is my life. It's my escape from reality.
And to further escape from reality, the wit and wisdom of Max Headroom.
I'm in control here now.
Control.
I think a lot of people feel generally suspicious of a computer age. I think is another reason why people respond to him.
Nice reply.
Yeah, nice reply, loser. Anyway, about those fathers. Here is a thoughtful montage from Ira Glass, of all people, back when he was a producer at NPR, valuable life lessons learned from dads.
My father taught me terrible eating habits, including putting mayonnaise on French fries, mayonnaise on whatever few vegetables we ever had.
We would wash our hair the way he did. When it was time for him to take a bath every night, we would make sure we took ours.
Well, I learned how to do repairs at home. Woodwork, shelving, we fixed the porch in the back.
My father taught me never drink milk when you can drink cream.
He would sit down right before church on Sunday and shine his shoes. And I would sit down and do the same thing.
You know, wanted to learn what he was doing.
My father taught me how to tell time. And in order to learn how to tell time, my father first had to teach me to count by fives. And I remember that, and I can picture the clock. It was blue and red.
He taught me how to play baseball. He used to take us to parks and organize teams and stuff like that.
He taught me how to play basketball.
I learned how to say a blessing in Hebrew over bread. I remember driving. We were driving in the in a yellow convertible with a black top on it. And here I am, this little kid. I'm looking up at him, and there's the wheel and the windshield. And here he is, you know, bending over the wheel, looking through the windshield. And I'm looking up at him, and he's telling me, he's saying, like, Robert, repeat these words. Baruch. And I said, Baruch. And I repeated it a couple times. Ta, ta. I thought he was just making up these words.
I had trouble staying in the lane when I was starting to learn how to drive. And my father realized it's because I was looking at the road directly in front of the car. And he said, pick a point out in the distance and look at that point, and you'll stay in the correct lane. And I do that, and now I can stay in lanes, but I still can't merge.
It wasn't a good thing to teach, but he kind of taught me that I could have anything I wanted. Whenever I see something in a store, for instance, and I said, Dad, I want this. And my mom said, no, you can't have it. And I turned around and I said, but Dad, and he got it. So I grew up thinking that you could have whatever you wanted.
I tell you one thing, he always encouraged us to work. He didn't allow no idleness. I always had chores around the house to do, you know, if I didn't have a job after school.
You know, he died young, very young, but you know, the time he was there, he was a hard worker. You know, he just, you know, showed us the right path.
My father was too busy earning a livelihood to be able to teach me anything.
There's nothing he really taught me, like how to do something, but I just remember him cursing a lot and learning these curse words at a very young age, though I was not allowed to repeat them.
He was a singer. He used to sing at the Elks Club on weekends. And he taught me that you don't really have to have a great voice. What you have to be able to do is to sell a song. That the great singers like Tony Bennett, they don't have good voices, but they know how to sell a song.
Thing I remember most vividly is being taught how to light a match because I had unreasonable dread fear of lighting a match. My father sat me down at the kitchen table one afternoon and through vast quantities of tears repeatedly made me light matches until I was able to do it for myself. And I didn't stop crying till we had gone through about a book and a half.
That's it. That's what my father taught me.
My dad, now here is a man.
Well, that's not quite it. Andre Codrescu discovered a more sporty angle to the good father role model.
My friend Keith took me and my son fishing the other day.
Keith's father took him fishing. He just screamed and hollered at me, Keith said. But they caught a lot of fish. Consequently, Keith sees the point. He goes fishing. My son thinks a father and son should go fishing because that's what he picked up somewhere, probably on TV. We fish. It's a beautiful day on Lake Bourne, which gives into the Gulf of Mexico. We've been launched into the water in Keith's motorboat with a bucket full of live shrimp and two bags of ice by an old geezer whose shack is bumper-stickered, patrolled by Smith and Wesson, and fight organized crime, abolish the IRS. The calm lake pacifies me almost at once. In the distance, there are shrimpers on their way to the Gulf. We stay near the mouths of the bayous where the trout are. I've never caught a fish in my life, and I don't care if I do, but there is a tug on my line. I reel in a speckled trout to the enthusiastic shouts of my son. Just as I do this, Keith's rod jumps violently. He reels hard, and there is a shark on the end of his hook. It's about 3 feet long, and it looks exactly like his cousin in Jaws. We net him with some difficulty and put him in the ice chest. For the next 2 hours, he thrashes powerfully in there. My son is now completely transported, particularly when, almost immediately, there is a second shark on Keith's line. This one fights harder, breaks the line, and is gone with the hook in his mouth. And so it goes. No more shark, but we pull in trout after trout, a real orgy of plenty and luck and excitement. I feel momentarily something like regret about not having fished with my father. My son is confirmed in his new faith. Keith's father looms behind all this, an archetypal father setting in motion all the sons of the world. The sun burns brilliantly over the marsh grass, full of red-winged blackbirds.
My dad, now here is a man.
And now for some thoughts from a guy who doesn't even consider himself above average. Here's commentator Tom Baudette.
As a person of mid-height from the Midwest with more and more middle-of-the-road views as I approach midlife, I guess I'm just an average guy. I'm what people refer to as the salt of the earth when they can't think up anything nice to say. One thing about being average is that there's a lot of us. We take some comfort in being normal but are painfully aware of how ordinary we are. We haul around our 2.6 children in our 1.8 cars and do the best we can on average incomes. Television producers and advertisers are constantly monitoring us to find out what we want in life, and the world is cursed with a vast array of conventional entertainment and mediocre products because of it. They don't even bother to take the rest of the population into account. They talk about common household germs like other households don't have germs. Vitamins are designed to average minimum daily requirements. We buy gas at Standard Oil. It's every place. Airline pilots judge the average airspeed as we sit in seats built for average butts. A world that once catered to its aristocracy is now dominated by the mediocrity. Just look at all the medications for irregularity. I think people should take some pride in being different. I don't see why they just can't leave it alone. Well, like most normal people, I wait for the day that something will happen to me that'll peel me away from the teeming millions and set me on a solitary path. Well, 10 years ago, I thought my plodding existence was going to finally try a hook shot. I had an accident and was almost killed. What luck. Everyone kept telling me how fortunate I was to be alive and how there must be something greater in store for me in life. Boy, was I excited. All I could think about was what the good Lord was saving me for and prayed it wouldn't have anything to do with religion. That's so typical, you know. Well, nothing's happened and I'm still waiting. But while I'm waiting, an average day will find my wife and I plying our trades and trying to raise a normal child who hopefully will grow up to do something conventional not too far from home and raise a normal healthy family of his own. They'll one day sit around a photo album of all of us and our parents and their parents in poses in front of strange cars with strange clothes on, looking stiff and uncomfortable. They'll laugh and muse and realize, as most average people do, how lucky we are to be the American dream and what fascinating characters we are to know.
Okay, so all that mediocrity is probably what gave rise to our next guest, Max Headroom. He was quite the phenomenon in the 80s, a creepy, computer-enhanced face engineered to sound like a mashup of famous talk show hosts, producer Peter White talks to NPR's Noah Adams.
You could actually take the sort of most endearing qualities of, say, David Letterman, Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, and if you fed into a computer all these ingredients, out would come, really, Mr. Perfect.
Good morning, Sydney. Good afternoon, Los Angeles. Good evening, England. And it's the Max Headroom Show. Tonight on the show, it's more pop videos. Max gives away prizes. Max looks back, forward, and meets the stars with his old buddy Sting. He's turned down a pro-am golf tournament to be here with you all tonight. He is the man of the moment. He is Mr. TV himself, Max Headroom.
Thank you.
He is the most pompous and most unctuous person we could imagine on television.
Okay, I won't take that as the personal dig. I'm sure it was meant to be.
He has a certain arrogance, which I suppose is born from being perfect. But I mean, he really is. He's got a very good sense of humor. He's very tongue in cheek, because he's sort of not a human being. He can say and do things that normal people, I guess, wouldn't do.
Your new album has a different feel to it with jazz musicians. Trendy. Has this been a musical learning process for you?
I think every album you do is a learning process, Max. I think you have to learn in order to enjoy your life. Am I boring you?
No, sorry. I just didn't get much shut-eye over the last week or two. It's just been all go here, you know. Superstardom on the upswing. Kind of tires a guy out. Now, can we deal with your shoes for a moment? Do you have any, how shall I put it right off the top of my head, color preference?
Let's go back a bit and explain that Max Headroom once was real. He was a television reporter. Tell us briefly what happened to this television reporter, Edison Carter.
Basically, it's set sort of too touchably 20 minutes into the future. And what basically happens is Edison is the chief investigative reporter, if you like, for a show called the What I Want to Know show. And Edison stumbles across a story which directly relates back to his own network on how they manage to keep their audience and stop them channel switching. And it has very serious side effects on the audience. And Edison discovers this story, and he has to be stopped. In being stopped, he has an accident. He's chased through the network out of a underground basement car park. And what basically happens is he hits the ramp, and he smashes into the crash barrier in the car park. And the last thing he sees as he sails through the air is Max Headroom.
It's a sign that says that warns trucks about going through.
That's right. Maximum headroom.
Yes.
And that's his last conscious memory, you see. And so he tends to sort of, he's reconstituted by the head of the research development. And he's recreated on as a talking head on the screen.
He's sort of a bionic television show host.
Good reply.
Now, does that explain this damage, this trauma? Does that explain why he is now just a bit out of control? He'd be talking normally in a normal voice and looking okay, and then things start jerking around, his voice starts changing.
I'm in control here now.
Control.
I think a lot of people feel generally suspicious of a computer age, and some feel even threatened. And so to see, if you like, a computer-generated character that has human failings and isn't perfect, I think is another reason why people respond to him.
Nice reply.
The Coca-Cola commercials, the very first one that's been shown in this country, the opening scene shows way up at the top of the screen, I had to see it twice before I noticed it, a sign that says Max Headroom, and then a truck comes along and Max Headroom falls off of a truck.
Right.
And he's in a television set there.
And this is Max Headroom.
Hi!
Ah, a new cocologist. Welcome.
We had several offers for Max, and the thing that really endeared us to Coca-Cola was the fact that when they came to London to talk about it, they actually had scripted storyboards. And we were more concerned, really, in the in the way that they use the character, so that we didn't, damage it and dilute it.
But at this point on a television show, on his television show, Max would have to ask, aren't you worried about overexposing Max Headroom?
you couldn't sort of walk in the street and yell Max Headroom and everybody know who you're talking about.
Talking with us from Los Angeles, Peter from Los Angeles, Peter.
Come on.
Peter Wagg, the creator of Max Headroom.
The big G. Golf. That's what it's all about.
Or the big G, Gone with the Wind. In 1986, the book celebrated its 50th birthday, which would make Scarlett O'Hara 75 today. Here's Atlanta reporter Bob Barr.
Just like in Margaret Mitchell's great novel, Atlanta is being invaded again, only this time it's by fans from around the country, whose devotion to the Gone with the Wind legend rivals that of any pop star.
Gone with the Wind is my life. It's my escape from reality.
I've read the book 11 times, and I've seen the movie umpteen times. And every time I see the movie, and every time I read the book, I still cry. It never fails. Even just listening to Tara's theme, I cried. Tara's theme was played at my wedding.
They played Tara's theme at the Gone with the Wind ball, and some women in their hoop skirts and crinolines did cry. But most were too busy having their pictures taken with the winners of the Rhett and Scarlett look-alike contests. Others were snapping up commemorative editions of the book. 50 years has passed, and Gone with the Wind is still at the top of the bestseller lists in Atlanta. No one would have been more surprised than Margaret Mitchell herself. Atlanta historian Franklin Garrett.
The author herself had little confidence in the book. In fact, she tried to recall it after she'd turned the manuscript over to the Macmillan Company representative, but he'd read enough of it to know how good it was, so he demurred. And I heard Margaret Mitchell say, I didn't know her until a few months before the book came out, one afternoon when I was with her and some other people, that she'd be very happy if it sold 1,000 copies.
200,000 copies were sold the first month. 1 million were bought by the end of the year. There was something in this story of wealth and romance that had a special appeal to a nation still mired in the aftermath of the Depression. One reviewer in Selma, Alabama, wrote that he wished every Yankee would read the book and just bust. Margaret Mitchell knew then that she had a hit. In 1937, it won the Pulitzer Prize. 25 million copies have been sold in 28 languages, more than of anything published except the Bible. Darden Tyron is an authority on the book who teaches at Florida International University in Miami.
The novel is very, very alive. It's still alive in part because when Margaret Mitchell wrote it, it was just bubbling with vitality. That's in part of her personality. It's in part the way she wrote the novel. And it is absolutely distilled in a character like Scarlett O'Hara.
Margaret Mitchell, Peggy her friends called her, was a fun-loving, thoroughly modern woman whose spirit is very much a part of the book she wrote. One friend said that at times she looked like a very good little girl, which she was. At other times, she looked like a very bad little girl, which she could be. But she was never a dull little girl. She was, he continued, a living combination of the fictional Scarlett and Melanie, with Scarlett's fire and toughness and Melanie's compassion and integrity. Celestine Sibley, a columnist for the Atlanta Constitution, remembers her this way.
She was terribly funny, one of the most entertaining women I ever saw, and irreverent, and didn't give herself airs. She didn't act like any celebrity. In fact, she didn't think it was a very good book. She said she couldn't be paid enough to read parts of it over again. She said, because some people criticized its literary merits, and she said she didn't think the writing was very good, but she had wanted to tell a story, and that's what she tried to do, and she did it magnificently.
The many fans of Margaret Mitchell who looked for reminders of her here were disappointed. Most of the places she lived and worked have been torn down. There are few historical markers and no museums. It's what she preferred. After her death in 1949, all her personal papers were burned, the manuscript of Gone with the Wind destroyed. She asked that a childhood home be torn down. She had no children herself. Her memorial is 1,037 pages long. Gone with the Wind was her only book, and it's her legacy. Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young is a Margaret Mitchell fan, too. He was at the Gone with the Wind ball the other night as well.
Atlanta has been put on the map by Gone with the Wind, Coca-Cola, and Martin Luther King.
It's a very diverse heritage, but it's a heritage that I don't think we ought to deny or run from.
This is Bob Barr for National Public Radio in Atlanta.
Gone with the Wind, Martin Luther King, and Coca-Cola. That is a really strange combination. And while they were celebrating Gone with the Wind in Atlanta, there were Juneteenth parties in Texas. Juneteenth, standing for June 19th, 1865, the day the Emancipation Proclamation finally made it to Texas. Here's Eskia Muhammad.
I guess the thing I like best about Juneteenth is red soda water. That's right, red soda water. And barbecue chicken, potato salad, mustard and collard greens, and red soda water served by the young men who'd be waiters and the young women who'd be waitresses. They would celebrate emancipation. And that's what red soda water is almost all about today, the original CP time. You see, the Emancipation Proclamation was late in order to keep the slaves in servitude just a little bit longer. 2 years, 5 months, 2 weeks, and 4 days late, but who's counting? The proclamation itself took effect 3 months after it was written, and how long overdue was the abolition of American slavery, period? So the black people of Galveston, Texas, were not late in beginning their celebration. They threw down their hoes and proclaimed their freedom instantly and unanimously. As soon as Major General Gordon Granger landed with 1,800 troops to enforce federal control over Confederate Texas, Dr. William H. Wiggins, Jr. of Indiana University wrote for the Smithsonian Institution's program on black American culture that some folks reported that an earlier black federal courier with no troops by his side was waylaid by highwaymen. Needless to say, the proclamation never arrived. But it was a spectacular event, free at last. So when they really got to celebrating in the 1940s and even into the 1950s, they'd have horse races, foot races. They'd have fun. And be proud. Juneteenth. It even has a soulful grammar. June 19th, 1865. Juneteenth. Emancipation Day. It was a festival. They would have black history speakers recounting the gallant exploits and progress of the African Americans up from slavery. They'd sing spirituals. They'd be truly uplifted. Last year, I joined a group of families, pilgrims really, who meet every year at a campsite on Chincoteague Island in Virginia to commemorate and celebrate. I'm so proud just to know we have a special reason for favoring those red soda waters in the summertime. In 1980, the Texas legislature proclaimed Juneteenth, along with Lyndon Johnson Day, a sacred official holiday. Happy Juneteenth to one and all. In these days of apartheid, I'm glad to celebrate the freeing of a captive, the freeing of a slave.
And now Noah Adams talks to a comedian whose act I really can't figure out.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm okay.
This is a pretty good connection. This isn't like Sprint, is it?
No, it's a fiber optic thing.
I guess the future is here, huh, Adam? No. What do you want me to call you?
Noah's fine.
Okay, can you call me Elvis? Would that be a problem?
Bob Goldthwait, a comedian known as the Bobcat. He is seen in the movies Police Academy 2 and 3, and he's the star of a new cable television comedy special on Cinemax.
Thank you very much. It feels good to be here tonight. It does not feel good to be here tonight. Turn the channel. Don't watch this show. TV Guide said I was an offense to nature itself, which I kind of liked because that implied that not only did I bum out like people, I bummed out like, you know, like plants and animals and dogs and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Are you drinking Tab right now?
As we speak, I'm pounding down a Frosty, yeah.
Tab, though.
Yeah, I call them Frosties.
We can name the brand here.
Oh, good.
It's been suggested that
the amount that you imbibe of this soft drink may be responsible for your large amount of energy.
Perhaps. I don't know. You know, I don't know. Like, if you ever read the side of the can, it's the same ingredients as a battery, so maybe you got something there.
I wanted to tell you, before I forgot, that I enjoyed the Cinemax thing very much. I saw a tape of it. We don't have cable here, but somebody sent me a tape of it. I saw it, and I actually laughed out loud for the first time in about 10 days.
Well, I'm either flattered or you're a very mad man.
I liked...
Can I tell you, Noah, to lighten up a little? Get a couple chuckles now and then, will you?
I liked the, for some reason, some perverse reason, the scene with the dog exploding.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, I wrote that in there because I wanted people to say, you know, I'm blowing up a dog. If you don't like me, turn the channel now, you know. So that was kind of why I put that in there.
Come in, boy! Come in, boy! Come in! Come in! Come on!
But you know what was hard in that scene? I'm going, come in, boy, come in, boy. And the dog would come. And so, you know, so we're having problems getting him to blow up. But I did a video for Michael Nesmith called Houdini the Pig, where I had a pig and I put him in handcuffs in a straitjacket. And then I put him in a burlap bag and I dropped him in a large tank of water. And then I'm looking at the, you know, the bag stops wiggling and my clock runs out and I'm going, I don't know, I think that pig ought to be out of there by now, huh? And so I smashed the glass. But so they said to me, you go, you can't put a pig in a tank of water, that's inhumane. So they hired a midget, which I'm going, oh, no, that's not humane. You know, I mean, sure.
What was the dog's name in the Cinemax special, Friday?
Yeah, boy, you read the credits.
Well, I always read the credits when dogs are involved.
When yeah. So I couldn't pull you away from a Lassie episode till the very, very last moment.
That's right. I should tell the audience that you are in New York and I'm in Washington and we can't see one another, but...
Do you want me to describe what I'm wearing?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a frilly unit.
Anyway.
Anyway.
After this interview, if you went downstairs to the coffee shop there on 2nd Avenue and I walked in and I hadn't, you know, I wouldn't recognize your picture, would I know that you had all this energy and that you were doing... what has been called maniacal comedy, and that you were like this, or would you just be a regular person?
I think it depends if you are obnoxious to me or not. Actually, I don't know. I'm pretty lethargic except when I'm performing.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I'm pretty much a zombie. I mean, I just get wired. See, like, I'm okay on the radio, but like when I'm on stage, that's the last place you'd want to be. You know, everybody's looking at you and stuff, and you know, I don't go up on stage and go, ah, this feels good. Let me tell you about my problems with my girlfriend now, or let me tell you why cats and dogs are different. I mean, that's not my act. I go up on stage and I tell them about everything that, you know, scares me.
Yeah. It's not comfortable at all for you to be on stage, it sounds.
Yeah, it's about as much fun as a good spinal tap.
Bob, I think we'll stop there. And I want to make sure that the dates are right for the New York opening is Friday?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good.
No, wait. Where am I? I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm Sunday for two shows.
Sunday?
Sunday.
Okay.
Well, if they go Friday, they'll get, like, really, really good seats.
That's the Bobcat, Mr. Robert Francis Goldthwait. We hope you've enjoyed this crazy madcap edition of Playback. I can't remember when we've had so much talent assembled in one place. Next month, Noah Adams interviews TV host Chuck Woolery about his hit show, The Love Connection. And we hear Americans describe America. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.